Hello, lovelies. It's Lady Curious again with another true crime story. This is going to be about the DC Beltway sniper attack in 2000s. This case had a bunch of information. I tried to dig as deep as I could. Maybe there's some stuff that I missed, but I tried to get the full story. I'm going to try to tell it to you as the best that I can. I am very sorry if my voice sounds a little different. I actually had a tooth break off and it's cutting into my tongue when I talk, so I sound a little weird, like I have a lisp. So I'm very sorry about that. I'm gonna try my best. It's been a long time. I know last month I skipped. I was having a lot of issues with my medication and I was not in a good health situation to actually be able to do the work and get a true crime story out last month. So I'm very sorry about that. Please remember this story is for educational and documentary purposes only. And what these two men did, one of them I could not even say is a man. He was only 17 years old, he was still a child. But I would more call them a dad and son duo. That's what I would say that they seemed more as. First, I would like to talk about the main person in this was the 40-year-old man, John Allen Muhammad, who was the mastermind behind all of this and the reason why everything went down. John Allen Muhammad, he was age 41 at the time. Born December 31st, 1960, in New Orleans, Louisiana. He got married to a woman named Mildred in 1988. John needed to learn how to read to get into the military, and at the time, Mildred helped him learn, and he actually ended up getting into the army because of Mildred. She helped him. He ended up becoming a very great marksman and an expert in hand-to-hand combat. He was very skilled in what he did. She said John was very charming and just seemed like a good guy, an all-American man that loved his country and seemed to have good core values. But the longer their marriage went on, they had three kids, two girls and one boy, together. She stated he was always a good father to their children, but eventually became abusive to her. After he got back from overseas, she said that he had bad PTSD and he wasn't the same person that he used to be before he went. That's when it got so bad she decided to separate from him. But then he got really stalkery. Like, he would stalk his wife for a very long time, would not leave her alone. So finally, she got a permanent restraining order against him. But you know, restraining orders, it's just a piece of paper. It doesn't really help. Unfortunately, at this time, he would do something horrible. And what he does, my ex actually did to me. And it's kind of crazy to say that. She still wanted him to see his kids. He wasn't a bad father. He was just a bad husband. That's what I would say. So she would let him visit, like maybe twice a month. She would let the kids visit with their dad. Well, only the second visitation after she got this permanent restraining order for herself against her husband, John decided that he was not happy with that situation. And he actually took their three kids and moved out of the country to Antigua. It's a Caribbean island. So he kidnapped the kids. And since she did not have a custody agreement, the exact same thing that happened to me with my ex-husband, since you do not have a custody agreement, if the child should be with you at that time or with him at that time or whatever, it's like fair game. You can't get each other on kidnapping because the mother and the father had the exact same rights of who can have the child at any time. Now, if you have a custody agreement in place, if it says, well, this specific month and you're in that specific month, the mom's supposed to have the kids, and the dad just takes him on the time that's not his to have the kids, She can, the cops can actually do something about it. They can actually go and say, no, the court custody says that you're not supposed to have them right now. Give them back to their mom. And if he does not, he can get charges for kidnapping. So since they did not have this agreement, she couldn't do nothing about it. She had no idea where they were. She did not have any contact with them for 18 months. Now, when this happened with me, it was 6 months, and I wanted to die without my child. I could not talk to him. I could not see him. I would do random, welfare checks just to make sure my kid was okay. But yeah, I know exactly what she was going through, but hers was for more than a year. It makes me tear up just thinking about it. He's a pretty shitty father too, if he can do that to his own kids, take them away from their mother. That just blows my mind. While they're in Antigua, that is where John met 17-year-old Malvo and unofficially adopted him from the streets. Supposedly, Malvo met them, and the kids actually stated it's like he just never left. He just was always at their house, hanging out with the kids, hanging out with John. And it was like John, you know how when you're like your best friends with somebody and you call their mom your second mom because you're over there all the time, and you actually have a relationship with their mom too, and you feel like they're your second mom because you love them almost the same as your own mom. Well, that's what happened. Malvo felt like John was his second dad, and John took him in as a son. I think Malvo even called him dad. When they finally came back to the United States, Mildred took John to court in 1999, and he was ordered to return the children to her and to get a divorce. Mildred's best friend, Isa Nichols, went to court with her to be a witness to everything that went on between Mildred and John because she was there from the beginning. Isa actually worked with Mildred's husband because John had a business, and Isa worked in the office with John. And then Mildred and Isa became best friends. Well, the war veteran, consumed by rage over the loss of his children and a custody fight with his ex-wife, whom he despised, talked Malvo. His real name was Lee Boyd Malvo, but I'm gonna call him Malvo because that's what I know him as. Age 17 at the time, he was a Jamaican immigrant to go on this killing spree with him across the United States to get revenge back on his ex-wife. Mildred did everything she could not to be found. To protect her children, she tried everything. But unfortunately, it wasn't even her fault that he kind of figured out where she was. John received some court documents that were sent to him about his case that had the area Mildred was living on the East Coast. The info wasn't like pinpoint coordinates to where she was, but kind of gave him a big area where she probably most definitely was. His whole idea was to find her, kill her, and kill anyone who helped her. He also decided to kill random people, so when she ended up dead, it would just seem like she was another victim of these anonymous shootings, that it would never tie back to him or Mavo. This started what is known as the DC sniper attacks, also known as the Beltway Snipe Killings, were a series of coordinated shootings that occurred during 3 weeks in October of 2002 throughout the Washington metropolitan area, consisting of the District of Columbia, Maryland, and Virginia. And preliminary shootings that consisted of murders and robberies in several states, Alabama and Georgia. And I want to say maybe Louisiana? I can't remember right now, but I will get more details into that. And lasted for 6 months starting in February 2002. Seven people were killed and seven others were injured in the preliminary shootings, and 10 people were killed and three others were critically wounded in the October shootings. In total, these two snipers killed 17 people and wounded 10 others in a 10-month span. Now, this whole time, they were like driving across and killing all these people to get to their one goal, Mildred, and to take his kids back, I'm guessing. He was teaching Malvo how to become a sniper. The weapon they were using was an AR-15 style military, and I think a 9mm is the other weapon. But let's get into the preliminary shootings, because when the shootings come out, it kind of ties all this together. On February 16th, by the way, is my birthday. So when I saw this date, it really broke my heart. February 16th, 2002, a 20-year-old cashier, Kenya Nicole Cook, was shot and killed by Lee Malvo, the front door of her aunt's home in Tacoma, Washington State. Cook's aunt is Isa Nichols, who was the good friends with Mildred and had encouraged her to seek divorcement from John. He was targeting Isa at the time, but since she wasn't home, he went ahead and hurt someone she loved. Malvo shot and killed 20-year-old. The 21-year-old, at the time of her tragic passing, she was working as a cashier. She was shot in the face and killed when she opened the door. But no decision had been made about charging the men until we know what happened. Malvo killed Kenya Cook, and Muhammad put him up to it. Malvo will die in prison. We cannot do anything more to them that hasn't already been done. Malvo, who confessed to a prison guard that he shot Cook, also told police and psychiatrists the shooting was Muhammad's way of testing him. Cook's aunt, Isa, worked for Muhammad's auto repair business. Isa found her niece's body inside her open front door after returning home from running an errand. Cook's 6-month-old daughter was found unharmed on a changing table, where she apparently was being diapered when her mother went to answer the door. Costello and Tacoma Police Detective Bill Webb met yesterday with Cook's mother, Pamela Nichols. Her granddaughter, Jean Nichols, and family attorney told them of their decision. I'm pretty satisfied because I was happy that even considered it after all this time, said Pamela Nichols. When all this happened, I wanted him dead immediately, she said. But she said that since the killing has come closer to God, the official motive remains unclear. But some speculate he was planning to kill his ex-wife and use the murders as a smokescreen to cover it up. John felt at some point within himself that this was his only recourse to a very elaborate scheme to get his children back, says Nichols. In the years since the first killing, Nichols has had to deal with the guilt and pain of her beloved niece being murdered instead of her. There were times I just hemorrhaged inside, said Nichols. She says she has put that all behind her. The final chapter is now at hand in the scheduled execution of John Allen Muhammad, a letter from the Commonwealth of Virginia inviting Nichols to witness the death. She plans to attend at the instance of her daughter. She said, Mommy, I want closure. I want to be there, said Nichols. I said, Well, if this is what you want to do, then we'll be there together. Isa Nichols says she has no answer to why she survived Muhammad's wrath when so many others did not. She hopes one day to find it. There was a purpose, and I'm hoping that I take my purpose and line it up with what God wants to do with sparing my life, said Nichols. So Muhammad wanted to hurt Isa for helping Mildred, and since he couldn't get to her, he decided to go ahead and just hurt someone close to her. And that's devastating for that young woman to be hurt like that. Now, a month later, around March 19th, 2002, a man named Jerry Taylor, who was 60, was killed by a single shot to the chest fired from long range as he practiced chip shots at a Tucson, Arizona golf course. Muhammad's sister lived near the golf course, and he was visiting her at the time of the shooting. Taylor, a married salesman with 3 children and 5 grandchildren, was shot while practicing chip shots at the Fred Inc. Golf Course in Tucson, Arizona. Authorities said he was felled by a single shot to the chest, fired from long range, and that many of the elements of his slaying were like the sniper killings. No bullet or shell casing was ever found. So if you think about this on the map, in February, they were in Washington State, and that's where the one girl got and killed. And then they moved all the way, him and Mavo moved all the way down and traveled to Arizona. And then that's where Jerry Taylor was killed. Supposedly, he was killed because they were practice shooting. And I guess a stray bullet hit him and killed him. And then on August 1st, 2002, in Hammond, Louisiana, so they're traveling along the coast, John Gaeta, 51, was changing a tire, slashed by Mavo at a parking lot. Mavo then shot him in the neck. The bullet exited through Gaeta's back, and he pretended to be dead while Mavo stole his wallet. Gaeta ran to a service station after Mavo left and discovered that he was bleeding. He went to a hospital and was released within an hour. And get this, March of 2010, he received a letter of an apology from Mavo. Like, what the hell? You on purpose shoot this man to rob him. And then you just 10 years later want to go, oh, I'm sorry. No, F that guy. On September 5th of 2002 at 10:30 p.m., Paul LaRuffa, a 55-year-old pizzeria owner, was shot 6 times at close range while locking up his Italian restaurant in Clinton, Maryland. LaRuffa survived the shooting, and his laptop computer was found in Muhammad's car when he and Mavo were arrested. With the money they stole from LaRuffa, they bought the blue 1990 Chevrolet Caprice sedan. LaRuffa said later it made him feel devastated that his money was the reason they could buy the Caprice. They stole $3,000 from him. So God was looking over this man. He survived after being shot 6 times. That is amazing. I'm just glad that he's still here. There is a video of him talking about it, and it will be something that he has to deal with for the rest of his life. He has a lot of medical issues from it. On September 14th, 2002, 22-year-old Rupinder Beni Obori, an employee of the Hillendale Beer and Wine liquor store in Silver Spring, Maryland, was shot in the back outside the store. Beni survived the shooting, but the shooting was officially linked to Muhammad and Mavo by the Montgomery County Police Department. So far it seems like they go to a lot of liquor stores and different places and rob and shoot and don't care about anyone except themselves. On September 15th, 2002, Muhammad Rashid was shot and survived while closing Three Roads Liquors in Brandywine, Maryland. Rashid later identified Mavo as a shooter in court. On September 21st, 2002, at 12:15 a.m., 41-year-old Millianwa Merriam was fatally shot in the head and back with a 22 caliber pistol in Atlanta, Georgia. While Merriam was helping the owner of a Sammy's, Million was helping the owner of a Sammy's package store close for the night when the shooting occurred. Million moved to Georgia in 1996 from Texas to be closer to the only relatives he had in the United States. When he was killed, she said he was helping the owner of Sammy's, a favor he would do for the time to time. That night, it was the wrong time and the wrong place for him. He died doing something nice for another person. The two store employees noticed a suspicious vehicle parked in front of the store. He walked outside to see why the suspects were sitting in a car, and then he was shot. The killing occurred 11 days after Muhammad bought that 1990 Chevy Caprice for just $250, the car he and Mavo usually used during the October sniper shootings. 19 hours later, on the same day of September 21st, Claudine Parker, a 52-year-old liquor store clerk in Montgomery, Alabama, was shot in the chest and killed during a robbery. Parker was about to leave to see her nephew play in the high school football game that night, but the proud aunt would never see the game, nor the rise of the Roman Harper, the son of her sister, Princess Harper, University of Alabama football star, nor his part in the New Orleans Saints 2010 Super Bowl victory. Her co-worker 24-year-old Kelly Adams was critically wounded with a shot through the neck, survived. Evidence found at the crime scene eventually tied this killing to the Beltway sniper attacks and allowed authorities to identify Muhammad and Malvo as suspects. Although this connection was not made until October 17th, almost 4 weeks later, well into the Beltway sniper attack. And these are the preliminary shootings before they get to the DC and Montgomery, Maryland area. On September 23rd, 2002, at 6:30 p.m., 45-year-old Tom Ballinger was shot in the head and killed in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Muhammad and Malvo were later linked to the killing. Hong Ballinger was a victim of the sniper killing spree led by John Allen and Malvo, also known as the Beltway Keepers. Ms. Ballinger, 45, a beauty supply store manager, was murdered as she left work and got into her car. The motive for her killing was robbery. In order to get a conviction of the first-degree murder case of Dean Harold Myers of Virginia, prosecutors needed to prove Muhammad guilty of multiple killings. In testimonies introduced during this trial, two eyewitnesses placed Malvo at the scene of Miss Ballinger's murder. Authorities in Baton Rouge positively identified a bullet recovered from the murder scene as matching a bullet fired from the same .223 caliber Bushmaster owned by John Muhammad. Miss Ballinger was a wife and the mother of three sons. Now, as you can tell, it was kind of weird. Like, they weren't going in like a straight line. It was like they went to Maryland, came back to Alabama area, then Louisiana area, then went back to DC, Virginia area. It was just they're all over the place. But what everyone knows is only of the main ones they did that I'm about to let y'all know. A lot of people, even myself, did not know about all the other murders that they actually did before the DC shootings. It was a very scary time. I kind of remember this case in 2002, but how old was I in 2002? I was in ninth grade. We knew it was kind of happening far away from us, but you still had that fear of, are you going to be driving down the highway and someone's just going to shoot you on the damn highway? Now, these are the attacks in the Baltimore, Washington area. It was DC and Montgomery County, Maryland area. At 5:20 p.m. on Wednesday, October 2nd, 2002, a shot was fired through the window of a Michael's craft store in Aspen Hill, Maryland. The bullet narrowly missed Ann Chapman, a cashier at the store. Since no one was injured, the shot was assumed to be random and no serious alarms were raised. But then, 1 hour later at 6:30 p.m., Mr. James Martin, a 55-year-old program analyst at the NOAA, was shot and killed in the parking lot at Shoppers Food Warehouse. He was a husband, a father, who had planned to buy groceries for his church group. He was a 1969 business graduate of Southeast Missouri State University, was a veteran employed as a program manager. He volunteered at the Shepherd's Elementary School in Washington, D.C., judging their science fair, speaking with their parent teacher association, and arranging computer donations. He was a resident of Silver Springs, Maryland. He was a husband and a father, a Boy Scout leader for his son's troop, and a church trustee. He was, in fact, at the Shoppers to purchase groceries for the church youth group that day. He was a Civil War buff and an amateur genealogist, actively researching his wife's Civil War ancestors and his own Missouri roots. His own father died when he was 8, and he worked his way through college. Friends remembered him as a lover of red wine who wore funny ties to church. He just seemed like an all-around good guy. And Martin was the first victim in the notorious DC shootings. Now, the rifle, as the world eventually learned, was a stolen Bushmaster XM15, a civilian version of the U.S. military's M16, equipped with a sighting scope The 223 caliber weapon would prove lethal again and again from long distances, even in the hands of a novice juvenile shooter. The next morning, Thursday, October 3rd, McNary got a call from home. She said there's been a shooting at a mobile station in Montgomery's Aspen Hill area. He recalled sleepily, "I said anything strange about it?" She said, "Yeah, people are saying it sounded like a cannon going off." And I'm thinking, oh man, a loud boom. That was the tell-end sign from the case I was working that night before. So, not knowing anything else at the time, I just jumped in the shower and headed over the scene. And that moment on, I stuck with it to the very end. I mean, it was a non-stop from there. And that was one of the detectives from the case that remembers when it all started. On the morning of October 3rd, four people were shot dead within the span of approximately 2 hours. At 7:41 a.m. on October 3rd, James Buchanan, also known as Sonny, I'm going to call him Sonny, was a 39-year-old landscaper. Sonny was shot while mowing the grass at the Fitzgerald Auto Malls. He had collapsed while cutting grass at an auto dealership. Initially, Sonny's death seemed accidental. Witnesses heard a boom as if the motor had exploded or had kicked up a heavy object that struck him. It took a while that morning for hospital personnel to determine that a bullet had torn into his back and come out through his chest. When word reached the Wallacre homicide scene, the landscaper had been gunned down in similar fashion 6 miles from the mobile station. McNary, the detective, could tell from looking at his fellow detectives that they were feeling shivers of dread as he said, "My God," he remembered thinking, "if this is a sniper case, we've got problems." Then, as the police walkie-talkie squawked with urgent calls from help elsewhere in the county, it was clear that their fears had been realized. Sonny was born March 4th, 1963, was known as a man with a big heart who was always ready to help others. The 39-year-old son of retired Montgomery County, Maryland police officer was an active volunteer at the local Boys and Girls Club. He was an amateur poet and taught children how to garden. Sonny was the dad to literally 400 kids. He came to the club 2 to 3 times a week, helped with homework, etc. Sonny previously ran a landscaping company but had gotten out of business. He was mowing the lawn of a former customer's car dealership near Rockville, Maryland. He had just relocated to Maryland to Virginia, concentrating his efforts on the family's Christmas tree farm. He continued to provide landscaping services to some of his customers just against habit. Sonny was a member of the Montgomery County Crime Stoppers, oftentimes providing products from his landscaping business for fundraisers. He spent numerous hours teaching the children how to plant a seed, nurture it, and watch it grow. The family created Sonny's Kids in his memory. It provides funds for a college education to underprivileged children. In addition, a granite marker surrounded by the blossoms he favored has been erected at the scene. So Sonny was a really good man as well. He really helped a lot of people. And he seemed like the guy if he'd give his shirt off his back if you needed it. He was very dependable. Same day, October 3rd, a little later at 8:12 a.m., a 54-year-old part-time taxi driver, Prem Kumar Wallacre, was killed in Aspen Hill in Montgomery County while pumping gasoline into his taxi at a mobile station at Aspen Hill Road and Connecticut Avenue. Prem Kumar Wallacre was a 50-year-old. The slug that pierced his left lung and heart at 8:12 a.m. appeared to have been fired from afar. As it turned out, Wallacre was victim number 3. It was his 25th wedding anniversary. I just wanted everybody to know that my dad was the greatest person I've ever met, said Wallacre's son Andrew. I'm glad he was my father. Ordinarily, the part-time cab driver from Onley in Maryland would not have been at the gas station at the time of day, but he was trying to finish his runs early so he could enjoy the warm afternoon. Walacker was born in India and had intended to retire there. At the age of 18, he immigrated to the area for studies at Montgomery College. He sent funds back to India, helping his siblings also immigrate to the United States. After he retired from a magazine business, he worked part-time as a cab driver. He was planning to retire soon and return to India. Per Indian tradition, his brother selected his bride. They had a son and a daughter. On that day, he left for work early, intending to take part in the day to celebrate the beautiful weather. A traditional Indian funeral service was held. Relatives said he worked hard and helped bring his siblings to America. He was a quiet man with a good sense of humor, they said. Same day, October 3rd, at 8:37 a.m. So these are like 20 to 30 minute part shootings. It's insane. Sierra Ramos, a 34-year-old babysitter and housekeeper, was killed at the World Shopping Center in Norbeck. She'd gotten off a bus and was seated on a bench reading a book at the time of her murder. She was victim number 4, was shot in the head. As she's just sitting reading a book, there are people around her. And remember, you're getting shot. The effing's fucking scary. She was waiting for her employer to give her a ride. She was born 1968. She was reading outside of the post office near a Silver Spring, Maryland retirement community when she was shot in the head and killed. A native El Salvadorian, Ramos was a member of several church groups and babysat for children and worked as a housekeeper. The thing that impressed me about Sarah, said her employer, when she walked into the room, not just a person walked in the room, but something walked in the room with her. Something that just warmed the house and your soul. Ramos was married and had a 7-year-old son. She was a very private person. Everyone that knew her remembered her as cheerful, loving woman dedicated to her child and family, her church, and her friends. Friends described Ramos as a hard-working immigrant who dreamed of building a prosperous life. Crazy how all these people are not at all connected. They're just randomly doing everyday life things, and then bam, out of nowhere, they get shot. That's freaking terrifying. The same day, October 3rd, at 9:58 a.m., 25-year-old Lori Ann Lewis Rivera was killed while vacuuming her Plymouth Grand Voyager at the Shell station at the intersection of Connecticut and Knowles Avenue in Kingston, Maryland. She was victim number 5. Lori was 25, a nanny. The minivan that she was vacuuming belonged to the woman she worked for. She was born May 4th, 1977. As she was getting ready to vacuum out the minivan, she was shot down. She grew up in a small town in Idaho and had recently moved east with her husband and daughter of preschool age. She was only 25. I mean, she comes and she goes, and suddenly she gets caught up in this. It's just devastating. There are no words for it. When still in junior high, she decided to become a professional nanny and moved to Oregon in 1996 to receive training. She was hired by a district journalist as a live-in nanny, relocating to Northern Virginia to assume her duties. She married a Honduran immigrant. They had one daughter. Although saving for their own home, they had recently moved into an apartment in Langley Park, which was closer to her new job as a daytime nanny. Her father, Maren Lewis, said she was special to everyone she met, and she brought friendship and love. Witnesses say they heard a huge loud noise like a bomb. It wasn't a bomb, but it was that kind of noise. Another witness in Silver Springs area gave a detective description of a medium-sized white truck, like a delivery vehicle, with a box-type rear, that he said had driven away hurriedly from the scene of Ramos' killing. Here was the origin of the mythical white box truck, thousands of which could be found cruising on the areas. For days, police seemed intent on stopping every white box truck they saw, often ordering occupants to get out with their hands in plain sight. It proved to be a time-consuming distraction in those tense weeks when every minute mattered for investigations. No such vehicle had been used in the crimes. Before the manhunt gained much traction, however, the sniper rifle boomed yet again. at 9:20 that evening. The snipers waited until 9:20 p.m. before shooting Pascal Charlotte, a 72-year-old retired carpenter, while he was walking on Georgia Avenue at Columbia Road in Washington, D.C. Charlotte died less than an hour later. He was victim number six. He was shot in the chest while standing on the street corner. Who would be next? Where would the killer or killers strike? Was anyone safe in this county? The terror, the anger, which seemed mainly confined to the Montgomery area on the first full day of mayhem, spread region-wide on October 4th after another random shooting. The gunfire, this time, was in Virginia, 75 miles south of the initial killing zone, about halfway to Richmond. Just like that, the geography attacks had widened considerably, jolting authorities. Pascal Charlotte was standing on the street corner and just got ambushed. Charlotte was a caretaker for his wife, who was fighting Alzheimer's disease. On the night of October 3rd, 2002, he made his wife dinner and walked out of their home to pick up a prescription. Then, boom, he was shot. Just like that, little more than an hour later, Charlotte was a retired carpenter and a father of five children. He came to the U.S. from Haiti in 1964 and spoke about living to 100. His grandson says his death left a void in their lives. Pascal was born April 20, 1930. He was the only sniper victim killed in the nation's capital. He is survived by his wife and five children. He was the type of guy that would fix things for his neighbors, a door jam for one, a box around a radio for another. He lived with his wife in a row house decorated with potted flowers on the porch and tomatoes and bell peppers in a small garden. Family and friends carry Charlotte's casket during his funeral service at the Shrine of Sacred Heart in Washington on October 19th, 2002. In each shooting, the victims were killed by a single bullet fired from some distance, and in each case, the killer struck and vanished. This pattern was not detected until after the October 3rd shootings occurred. Fear quickly spread throughout the region as news of shootings spread. At a press conference meeting, Chief of Police for Montgomery County, Charles Moose, informed parents that schools were on a code blue alert, keeping children indoors. He said that schools were safe. Many parents picked up their children early at school, not allowing them to take a school bus or walk home. Montgomery County public schools and district schools and private schools went into a lockdown with no recess or outside physical educational classes. Other school districts in the area also took precautionary measures, keeping students indoors. During the course of the shootings, law enforcement agencies from the neighboring states became embedded in the investigation through telephone tips. Police had only a few pieces of evidence to work with. One initial report that rang initial report said that right after the Silver Spring attack, someone had reportedly heard a popping noise and had seen a white box truck leave the scene. After the murder, the Washington, D.C. began telling police they had seen a blue Chevy Caprice rather than a white box truck. The police initially believed that all the murders were carried out with a .223 caliber rifle. Now, that was Maryland and D.C. area. I'm telling you. Well, a man and a little boy. Father-son duo, if you want to say, really wreaked havoc on the East Coast. I mean, I've seen videos where people were talking about how they were scared to go outside. They were scared to be driving in their cars. They were scared to just do normal things. Just think, it lasted for a whole month. The Virginia and other areas. At this point, Mavo Muhammad started covering a wider area and taking 2 to 3 days between shootings. Now, on October 4th is when they moved to this area. A 43-year-old homemaker, Caroline Seawall, was wounded in the chest at 2:30 p.m. in the parking lot of another Michaels store while she was loading purchases into her minivan. By this point, hundreds of journalists had covered the unfolding events. School officials reassured the public that they were taking every measure possible protect their children. But when the work and school week resumed 3 days later, so did the shootings. Carolyn Sewell, 43, a mother of two who survived her wound, was shot in the lower back while loading bags into her minivan in front of Michael's store. "You're looking for a needle in a haystack," said Detective McNary. "Now, you thought you were looking for a needle before. Suddenly you're looking in a much bigger haystack, a gigantic one." 3 days later, on October 7th, came perhaps the most stunning attack of those bloody 3 weeks. A shooting that sent an especially frightful signal to parents and school children, while vastly intensifying the horror pervading Greater Washington. In Prince George's County, Maryland, bordering Montgomery, the rifle boomed from a grove of trees near a middle school at 8:09 a.m. on a Monday, as students climbed off buses and out of cars to start a new week of classes. With the snipers at large, the public learned that morning kids were no longer safe, safer than adults. Now, this was on October 7th at 8:09 a.m. Iron Brown, a 13-year-old student, was shot in the chest, critically wounded, as he arrived at Benjamin Tasker Middle School in Bowie, Maryland. Brown's name was initially withheld from the public, but years later, it was revealed. His aunt, Tanya Brown, was a nurse who had just brought him to school, and she rushed him to the hospital emergency room. Despite sustaining serious injuries, including damage to several organs, Brown survived the attack and ultimately testified at Muhammad's trial. At the crime scene, the authorities discovered a shell casing as well as a tarot death card inscribed with the phrase, "Call me God," on the front, and on three separate lines on the back, "For you, Mr. Police. Code, call me God. Do not release to the press." Despite police efforts to honor the request not to release the information about the card to the press, details were made public by the Washington Post. Now, Iron was victim number 8 of this rampage. He was the youngest target in all of the killings. He was a survivor. He was shot in the abdomen while walking from school drop-off, and he had his football jersey on and toting a backpack. And near a wooded spot from which the bullet apparently had been fired, investigators found an occult tarot card. Can you believe these assholes literally took a tarot, the death card from the tarot card, and wrote what I just previously said on it, put it in like a little baggie, and then literally pinned it to the tree? That just blows my mind. Like the balls, you know, like they literally were trying to do kind of like a tarot, like a calling card, if you would say that. They were serial killers. Like the Zodiac Killer had a calling card. It's kind of something like that. As forensic experts studied the card for clues, the killings went on, mostly in Virginia. The life or death of drama unfolding around the nation's capital seized global attention. Every day, a phalanx of investigators were wearing grim expressions fronted by the door. Combative Chief Moose faced scores of news cameras and questions, and the officials usually said little because they had nothing much to share. The more persistent the inquiring, the more obvious was Moose's disdain for the press. "I have not received any messages that the citizens of Montgomery County want Channel 9 or the Washington Post or any other media outlet to solve the case," he said at one briefing, bristling with annoyance. "If they do, then let me know and we will turn the case over to the media and you can solve it." They had no leads. They were aggravated and with public opinion breathing down their necks and wondering what is taking so long. These people are just running around town murdering people. Do something, do something. So these investigators and everyone was in FBI, just know all. I can't even think of the name, but the FBI and surrounding police departments and sheriff's departments and all of them were on deck. Like it was even the president at the time said some words about this. It was a huge thing. Huge. It was very scary. So, now on October 9th at 8:18 p.m., 53-year-old civil engineer Dean Harold Myers was shot dead while pumping gasoline at a Sunoco gas station near Prince William in Prince William County, Virginia. He was victim number 9. Dean, a 53-year-old civil engineer, was shot behind the left ear while gassing up his Mazda at a Sunoco. He was born May 17th, 1949. Unfortunately, that shot killed him. He was from Gaithersburg, Maryland, and a Vietnam War veteran. Native to Obelisk, Pennsylvania, he loved old cars, a hobby he shared with his father and brothers, but would have survived, surprised his co-workers had they known. To avoid the draft, he enlisted in the army and was sent to South Vietnam in May of 1969. He received the Purple Heart for wounds received in hostile action on March 8th, 1970, and a permanent disability for the same. Although he spent over a year in recovery, he graduated with a civil engineer degree from Penn State in 1975. He relocated to Northern Virginia to work in the field. Never married, he was an active uncle to his brothers and his friends' children, and a longtime sponsor to several children through World Vision, an anti-poverty mission. He loved the outdoors, especially the waterways. Contributions to conservation-related charities were among the numerous receipts found after his death. Friends and co-workers said he was hardworking and thoughtful, someone who would help carry heavy packages and feed stray cats. I mean, that's good, but terrible that he had to pass away. He seemed like a good guy. These people were real people. I wish I could find more about them, but I dug and dug and dug as deep as I could to try to find out more about these people, because a lot of the things I did find out about them, it was not that much. And I was, you gotta think about it. Everyone wasn't into true crime and more vocal online in 2002 when this happened. On the morning of October 11th at 9:30 a.m., 53-year-old businessman Kenneth Bridges was shot dead while pumping fuel at an Exxon gas station. He was victim number 10. He was an interpreter. He was shot in the back. He was fueling his Buick at the Exxon, close to where Sewall had been wounded in Fredericksburg. He was born June 24th, 1949. He was the co-founder of a marketing distribution company. Bridges was in the area on a business trip. A friend, Gary Shepherd, said the family was shocked and saddened by this senseless event. Ken was a loving husband, father of 6 children, and an outstanding citizen of the Philadelphia community. While no family should have to endure this type of tragedy, the Bridges family hopes that this killer is brought to justice as quickly as possible. Kenneth, he grew up in Detroit, Michigan, graduated from Hillsdale College in Michigan in 1971, and from the University of Pennsylvania's Wharton School of Business in 1973. He worked as an executive to Scott Paper Company, but to the surprise of many, he left the corporation in 1980. He was the co-founder and president of MATAH Network, an organization formed in 1997 to encourage African Americans to support Black-owned businesses. He was in Virginia on business. He was a resident of Germantown, a neighborhood of Philadelphia. He was a dedicated family man and was often found playing basketball with his wife and 6 children. Neighbors spoke of his friendliness and love of playing basketball with his 6 children. Family members and attended his memorial service on October 15th, 2002. Now, with Bridges, I found more pictures than the others. It seemed that he had a social media presence. On October 14th at 9:15 p.m., 47-year-old Linda Franklin, an FBI intelligence analyst who was a resident of Arlington County, Virginia, was shot dead in a covered parking lot at Home Depot in Fairfax County, Virginia. just outside Falls Church at Seven Corner Shopping Center. The police received what seemed to be a very good lead after October 14th shooting, but it was later determined that the witness was inside the Home Depot at the time and was lying. The witness, Matthew Dowdy, was convicted of interfering with the investigation. By the point, no one felt safe being outdoors in public. Gas stations had begun to put tarps up to conceal their customers. Some people crouched over while pumping their gas, while others waited in their cars. Malvo and Muhammad did not commit any more shootings for 5 days before striking again. Now, Linda was victim 11. She was shot in the head while putting packages in her Mercury at a Home Depot. Looking back, it's surreal the way it impacted the lives of millions of people in our region. He recalled his wife phoning him at headquarters one evening to say she wanted to go out to get gas for her car, but he wouldn't hear of it. "I told her no," said Manger, who'd been chief of the U.S. Capitol Police since July 2021. "I told her I'll run home and get gas for you. It was maybe 7 o'clock on the weeknight. I got the gas in Tyson's Corner, and it was a ghost town. I mean, Tyson's at 7 at night would be nothing but wall-to-wall traffic and people. But it was empty. I'm looking around and remembering it was just really creepy. By the point, almost every jurisdiction with a sniper shooting had set up its own joint operations center." Well, Linda Franklin was victim number 11. Even at the age of 47, after a battle with cancer and a tense year of post-terrorist life in the nation's capital, Linda Franklin seemed to be blessed with eternal youth. Whenever she came home to visit family in Gainesville, she would round up nephews, nieces, and young cousins for camping trips to Camp Landing, bringing along plenty of supplies for shaving cream and water balloon fights. On vacations in older, colder climates, she would often zoom down the ski slopes in an inner tube, and wherever she went, she was likely to be mistaken for a woman in her 20s. Linda was still getting carded in bars. Family members said she was in the prime of her life. She wasn't a daredevil, but she wasn't afraid of anything. Not a thing. Anything she wanted to do, she just could do it. Family members said it was Franklin's can-do spirit that led the former Gainesville resident to a job with the Federal Bureau of Investigations. Franklin was 15 when her family moved to Gainesville. Her father worked at Vital Industries, a video production equipment company that just had moved its headquarters here. Franklin had two children of her first marriage. Her son, Tom, 25, recently graduated from University of West Florida with a law enforcement degree. Her daughter, Katie, 23, lives in Washington, D.C. area with her husband, scuba instructor. The family members say they never really knew much about what she was doing for the FBI. She wouldn't say a word about the details of the job, even to her father, a former Air Force radar instructor who had held a high-level security clearance. Father said that she had a fine work ethic. If there was a chance she would reveal something classified, she wouldn't say anything at all. But she did tell her parents that she expected to be transferred to the nation's new Homeland Security Agency, and that she wasn't sure whether the transfer would take her to a new city. The chance of transfer to a new location led Linda and Ted Franklin to sell their home and move into a rental property. Franklin family members said they were at the Home Depot buying supplies for the move when she was shot. Escaped on threat, the Moores said the attacks were particularly shocking because their daughter had already escaped one threat of her life. Franklin was diagnosed with breast cancer in 2001. They said they worried about their daughter's safety in the Washington area after the sniper attacks began. A family member said Franklin didn't let the sniper scare her, though she knew people had had a hard time finding the shooter. "I was just talking to her the other day as she was cleaning out her apartment," Marion Moore said. She said there's three white vans parked outside right now. There are more white vans in D.C. than any other kind of car. The Moores first heard about the shooting at 2 a.m. Tuesday morning when a group of FBI agents and Gainesville police officers came to their house to break the news. By the early Tuesday morning, Charles Moore said he was still in shock. "I haven't digested it yet. It still seems unreal. I haven't been able to get the grief stage or the anger stage yet." But the anger is coming. particularly when he thinks of the choices that random sniper has made, particularly in decision to shoot a woman standing next to her husband. What's amazing to me is that Ted is a big guy and she is a small woman, he said. So he passed up an easier target to hit a 5'2" woman. Of course, you don't want anyone to get shot, but this person initially picked a woman instead of a guy, and he shot a 13-year-old boy. Then this has got to be one sick person. Family members say Franklin's funeral service will be held in Washington. They said that she studied terror threats. Franklin had beaten breast cancer, raised two children and a niece, particularly by herself. And she was expecting her first grandchild. She and her husband was getting ready to move to a bigger house or buying supplies when she was killed. That is heartbreaking. She had children. She about had a grandchild coming, and she was actually moving because of her job was moving her. She had so much to live for, and it's fucking heartbreaking. A break in the case, indeed. Muhammad and Mavo had reportedly called sniper tip lines and other numbers over the weeks, hoping to work out a $10 million payment for halting their attacks, but it was a struggle for them to reach anyone in authority. On October 19th at 8 p.m., 37-year-old Jeffrey Hopper was shot in a parking lot near the Ponderosa Steakhouse at State Route 54 in Ashland, Virginia, about 90 miles south of Washington. His wife, Stephanie, called out to a passerby who phoned for an ambulance, enabling Hopper to survive his injuries. Authorities discovered a four-page letter from the shooter in the woods that demanded $10 million and made a threat to children. Hopper was victim number 12. He was 37. He was just passing through the area from Florida, and he was shot in the abdomen. So frustrated were the snipers at not being able to contact upper officials about their $10 million demand, Malo called a Catholic monitor and was just babbling anonymously about difficult time they were having. In doing so, he indirectly gave investigators a break they've been desperately hoping for. Mavo mentioned a robbery homicide he committed in an Alabama liquor store in September, shortly before the D.C. area killings began. After the Catholic Church relayed this story to the Sniper Task Force, authorities phoned police in Alabama and learned that fingerprints from the store hadn't yet been sent to the FBI for identification. The FBI processed them immediately, and they matched those of a Jamaican teenager, Mavo, who had been once detained in the U.S. immigration agent. Mavo's closest associate, Muhammad, lived in Washington State. Investigators learned that Muhammad thought of Mavo as a son and a protege. An old army buddy of Muhammad's told them that for several reasons he suspected Muhammad had orchestrated the sniper rampage with the aim of eventually murdering his hated ex-wife, Mildred Muhammad, who lived in Maryland with their three children. This and other evidence convinced authorities that Muhammad and Mavo were the long-sought killers. Records showed Muhammad owned that blue Chevy Caprice with New Jersey license plate. The car had to be located and quickly, but where was it? Ashland police found a shell casing and a message tacked to a tree in nearby woods. A multi-page letter accused the police of ineptitude, demanded $10 million, and threatened more killings. A 37-year-old man from Melbourne, Florida, was shot and wounded at 8 p.m. on October 19th as he and his wife were leaving that restaurant. And the couple were traveling through the state. The bullet pierced the man's upper abdomen and tore through several organs. Surgeon removed part of the stomach and left half of the pancreas and the entire spleen. His surgeon said the victim, who is 6 feet tall and weighs about 200 pounds, is a very strong man, and once he comes out of this, I think he'll have a normal life. But it's going to be a bumpy road and a long process. The victim's wife issued a statement thanking the people of Richmond for their support and prayers for her husband. She also asked people to pray for the attacker and that no one else is hurt. It continues, y'all. It continues. On October 21st, Richmond area arrested two men, one with the white van outside a gas station. The men turned out to be illegal aliens with no connection to the shooter. The pair were administrated cavity searches and were redeemed into federal custody. What was when the immigration when they were deported. The next day on October 22nd, a bus driver, Conrad Johnson, 35, was shot at 5:56 a.m. Johnson died of his injuries. On the same day, Chief Moose released part of the content of one of the shooter's letters, in which he declares, "Your children are not safe anywhere at any time." While no shootings occurred on October 23rd, the day is significant for two events. First, ballistic experts confirmed Johnson as the 10th fatality, but he was the 10th, he was the 13th victim in the Beltway shooting. Second, in the yard of Tacoma, Maryland, police searched with metal detectors for bullets, shell casings, and other evidence that might provide a link to shooters. They found a tree stump believed to have been used for target practice was seized. So, more about Conrad. He was 35 years old. He was a bus driver. He was just standing in the doorway of his empty bus and was shot. Johnson was the last to die, the final target. His widow, Denise Johnson, said recently that she had to reinvent life without her husband. Her two boys are now adults. She has not remarried. "It's a struggle, to be honest," she said. "Still hits us to this day. It doesn't lessen." But normalcy would return to the region. About 3:15 a.m. on October 24th, 2 days after Johnson's killings, heavily armed police and federal agents arrested Muhammad and Mavo at a highway rest stop north of Montgomery, where the snipers had been snoozing in the Caprice. They gave up without a struggle. The Bushmaster, with his attached bipod for adding firing accuracy, was in the car too. Ballistics test would definitely link the rifle to all but a few of the 13 shootings, and authorities believed it was used in every case. Besides the sniper killings, the two were implemented in nine other shootings. Five of them were fatal in Washington State, Arizona, Georgia, Alabama, Louisiana, and Maryland. Most of those attacks occurred in September. As the two headed for the D.C. area, zigzags across the country towards infamy. Mavo was sentenced to nine life terms, is now 37, and incarcerated in Virginia, where his first application for parole was recently rejected. Thank God. "I was a monster," he said in a 2002 prison interview with the Post, describing himself as having been in thrall of a much older Muhammad. Mavo said, "I was a ghoul. I was a thief. I stole people's lives. I did someone else's bidding just because they said so. There's no rhyme or reason or sense." Muhammad got six life terms in Maryland and a death sentence in Virginia for killing of Dean Myers. The ultimate penalty was meted out to him on November 10th, 2009, in a stark concrete block called L Unit. As Myers' brother Bob Myers looked on, the prisoner offered no last word. They injected him, and pretty soon he was still, Myers recalls. That was it. Father, too, was a 10-year county employee who loved basketball, loved his kids. Johnson from nearby Oxnard was shot in the stomach, getting off the bus in a staging area for Montgomery County's ride-on commuter line. He was just getting his bus ready for a morning commuters on his busy weekday route when he was shot down. A cousin said the married father, too, was definitely a pillar to his community and his family. A neighbor remembered him as a funny, devoted father who had a passion for football and weightlifting. What happened was this man was tired and he was actually in a white box truck, the irony of it. And he pulled over at a resting area and he said that he looked over and saw the Chevy Caprice, and he actually had been following what was happening with the sniper case. And so he called it in. They came. They surrounded the car and they woke him up and got them. They effing got them. If that man was not there at that time and place, more people probably would be dead. I practically told you the gist of this case. I tried to make it as short as I could. There's more stuff that I would like to talk about. The arrest, it actually was at 3:15 a.m. on October 24th, 2002. What they found in the car, evidence experts from the FBI and other police forces found, was both revealing and shocking. The car had a hole cut in the trunk near the license plate so that the shots could be fired from within the vehicle. Like a guy was like, because I'm going to put pictures in here of what it looked like. There's actually a video that shows the police show exactly how they had set up to be concealed and to shoot people, and they didn't know where it was coming from. They did it out of the trunk of the car as the car was moving. They found the tripod and the Bushmaster rifle. The back seat had a sheet metal removed between the passenger compartment and the trunk, enabling the shooter to get into the trunk from inside the car. Digital voice recorder used by both Malvo and Muhammad to make extortion demands. A laptop stolen from one of the victims containing maps of the shooting sites, getaway routes, and from some of the crime scenes, and map walkie-talkies and many more items. The motive, we already told you, he wanted to kill his ex. You know, and to this day, Mildred gets hate from people and gets blamed for this, that it's all her fault, that if she never would have moved away from him, none of this would have happened. She was moving away to protect her and her children. She had no idea he was going to snap, literally snap, and decide to go on a murder spree. Had no idea. While in prison, Marlowe wrote a number of erratic diatribes about what he termed against the United States. "I have been accused on my mission. Allah knows I'm going to suffer now," he wrote, because his rants and drawings featured not only such figures as Osama bin Laden, but also characters from the film series The Matrix. These musings were dismissed as immaterial. Some investigators report that they had all but eliminated terrorist ties or political ideologies as a motive. Nonetheless, in at least one of the ensuing murder trials, a Virginia court found Muhammad guilty of killing pursuant to the direction or order of terrorism. While Muhammad died, he was put to death. At the 2006 trial of Muhammad, Mabo testified that the aim of the killing spree was to kidnap children for the purpose of extorting money from the government and to set up a camp to train children how to terrorize cities, so the ultimate goal of being to shut things down across the United States. Mabo also stated that Muhammad was driven by his hatred for white people and his beliefs that the white man is the devil. The plan was to kill 6 white people per day for 30 days, and he told Mavo he wanted him to shoot pregnant white women. That is disgusting. That is racism right there. And he makes a point now talking about that, why would he just kill her, a little white woman, instead of a big white man? I don't know. It kind of makes sense, y'all. That's crazy. So they're terrorists, but the main goal, everyone believes, is because of his ex. Something snapped in that man. In September 2003, Muhammad was sentenced to death. In October, Mavo, a juvenile, was sentenced to 6 consecutive life sentences without parole. In 2009, Muhammad was executed by lethal injection. In 2017, the United States Courts of Appeal vacated Mavo's 3 life sentences without parole in Virginia on appeal, with resentencing order pursuit of the Supreme Court ruling in a case of Miller versus Alabama. which held that mandatory life sentences for juvenile criminals without possibility of parole violated the Eighth Amendment of the United States Constitution. That Mavo should be resentenced. Mavo's minimum prison sentence will be determined by a judge on February 25th, 2020, after the passage of Virginia allowing those who are serving life sentences for offenses committed before the age of 18 to seek release after serving 20 years. Y'all, they had Maryland trials, they had Virginia trials in 2005, 2006. He was executed in 2009. Mavlo's testimony in John Allen Muhammad's May 2006 trial. Lee Boyd Mavlo took the stand and confessed to the 17 murders. He also gave a more detailed version of the pair's plans. Mavlo, after extensive psychological counseling, admitted that he was lying at the earlier Virginia trial, where he admitted to being the trigger man for every shooting. Mavlo claimed that he had said this in order to protect Muhammad from a potential death sentence and because it was more difficult to obtain the death penalty for a minor. Mavlo said that he wanted to do what little he could for the families of the victims by letting the full story be told. In his 2 days of testimony, Mavlo outlined details aspect of all shootings. Now, this is all information I found online, y'all. Public information, okay? Part of his testimony concerned Muhammad's complete multi-phase plan. His plans consisted of three phases in the Washington, D.C., and Baltimore metro areas. Phase one consisted of planning, mapping, and practicing their locations around the D.C. area. This way, after each shooting, they would be able to quickly leave the area on a predetermined path and move to the next location. Muhammad's goal in phase one was to kill six white people a day for 30 days. Mavo went on to describe how phase one did not go as planned due to heavy traffic and the lack of clear shot or getaway at locations. Phase two was meant to take place in Baltimore, Maryland. Mavo described how this phase was close to being implemented but was not carried out. Phase two was intended to begin by killing a pregnant woman by shooting her in the stomach. The next step would have been to shoot and kill a Baltimore police officer. Then, at the officer's funeral, they planned to donate several improvised explosive devices completed with shrapnel. These explosives were intended to kill a larger number of police, since many police would attend another police officer's funeral. The last phase was to take place shortly after phase two, which was to extort several million dollars from the United States government. This money would be used to finance a larger plan to travel north to Canada. Along the way, they would stop at YMCAs and orphanage, recruiting other impersonal young black boys with no parents or guidance. Muhammad thought he could act as their father figure, as he did with Mavo. Once he recruited a large number of young black boys and made his way up to Canada, he would begin their training. Mavo described how John Muhammad intended to train boys in weapons and stealth as he had been taught. Finally, after their training was complete, John Allen Muhammad would send them out across the United States to carry out mass shootings in many other cities, just as he had done in Washington and Baltimore. These attacks would be coordinated and be intended to send the country into chaos that had already been built up after 9/11. That is fucking gross. He was a damn monster, y'all. August 30th, 2022, Mavo, now 37, was denied parole after federal courts had ordered him resentenced after Virginia had passed a 2020 law creating the possibility of parole for juvenile offenders serving life sentences. Considering your offense and your institutional records, the parole board wrote, the board concludes that you should serve more of your sentence before being paroled. So he was denied recently. Mavo was. He needs to stay in there for life. He does not need to get out. You know, Mavo said something that struck me. He goes, being with Muhammad was like being in a cult of only two. I thought that was kind of a weird, but kind of a good perspective of how he felt when all that was going on. They do have a memorial for the victims of DC area sniper attacks located at Brookside Garden in Wheaton, Maryland. So if you ever want to go, they have like a really big constructed, a big granite headstone type of thing in the government plaza to memorialize the people that lost their lives during this horrible time. That is really all the information that I have, but that was a lot of information I just kind of threw at you. I don't know if it really made that much sense, but I tried my best to keep it going. Muhammad died, death sentence for killing all the people, and Mavlo is still in prison. I think he's going to be in there for the rest of his life. They were already terrorists, they're serial killers, but oh, I'm just so happy that they got stopped. Do you understand? If he went through that, he would have ruined so many ways his future. He would have ruined a lot more people's lives. He was wanting to hurt a lot of people. And I really do believe that he had something mentally going on with him. Just losing your wife and kids would not make you have that happen to them all the time. And they don't snap and want to go on a murder spree like he did. Something was off up there, and I wished that he could have got help. Manipulated Mavo to doing this with him is just disgusting. I hope y'all enjoyed this. I hope y'all learned some more about this, 2002 DC sniper case with me. My husband was the one that told me I should do this case, but when I got into it, I was like, man, this is a lot of heartache. And my heart goes out to all the families that lost people to these crazy, insane people, to these two guys. And it blows my mind that just two people can spread so much carnage. And I'm very sorry to the other victims who had gotten wounded and hurt mentally and physically by these two men. This was a while back, more than 20 years. This was such a long time ago. I usually don't do older cases, but I just wanted to kind of remember all the victims that these two men took away from their loved ones. And I'm praying that they are all in heaven and they're in a better place and they're smiling down upon people that they love. Thank you so much. Please like and subscribe. You liking and commenting and subscribing really helps, makes me want to do this more. Makes me go, man, people do like my videos. They like my narration. They like my passion for telling people's stories and remembering these people's lives. But like I said, please like and subscribe. Comment down below what you think about this story. It was all over the place. Sorry about that. I love y'all very, very much. And please stay safe. Stay vigilant. If you see something, say something, okay? I'll talk to y'all until the next one. See y'all later. Stay safe.